This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. The HBO comedy series Veep, which satirizes American politics, has started its sixth season. It also just won a Peabody Award. My guest Frank Rich has been an executive producer of the series since it started. It seems like a perfect job for him. He understands the theater aspect of politics. He served as the New York Times theater critic from 1980 to 1993. For about 8 years after that, he wrote a column for the Sunday Times about the intersection of politics and popular culture, a subject he continues to write about for New York Magazine. We'll talk about what's currently happening at that busy intersection, but let's start by talking about Veep. The main character, Selina Meyer, played by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, started the series as the inept vice president. Later in the series, when the president resigned to take care of his sick wife, Selina inherited the role of leader of the free world, a job she was totally ill-equipped for. She wants power and fame, but has no vision, no core beliefs, and even if she did, she wouldn't have the savvy to translate that into policy. After serving as president for less than a year, her term expired, and she ran for president. The election ended in a tie in the Electoral College, requiring the activation of arcane congressional rules to decide the winner, and she lost. When the new season starts, Selina's trying to redefine herself and do the things ex-presidents do, but what she really wants is to be president again. In this scene from the season premiere, she's arranged to travel to Omaha and reveals her secret motive for the trip to her assistant Gary, played by Tony Hale.
I'm going to tell you something, okay?
Okay.
But it's top secret.
Ooh, I love secrets.
I'm going to go to Omaha because...
Okay.
Omaha is a 20-minute drive right across the border
to
Council Bluffs, Iowa.
Beautiful.
Where they have their annual Madison Monroe dinner.
Fun.
Which you have to go to if you're going to run for president again.
Huh?
I'm going to run for president again.
That is a great idea.
I know.
I think you're definitely ready for this.
Yeah, I feel so great about this.
You should.
Yeah.
Are you sure you're ready for this?
So I'm going to tell the whole family about it tonight. You know, I mean, such as it is, whatever. And if any one of them objects, then... it's okay. I just won't run.
Well, you got my vote.
Why would I need your vote?
You wouldn't. It's just, what a crazy idea.
Frank Rich, welcome to Fresh Air.
So, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk first about the new season of Veep. So Selina was vice president, then takes over as president, and now her presidency is over. And the clip we played is a little misleading because it sounds like she's going to run again. She's not going to run again because she's got no support from anybody, including her own people.
including her own family,
outside of maybe Gary. So why did you want to make it clear right at the start of this new season that she's not going to run again? That part is over.
We wanted to do that because I think that, you know, as Dave Mandel, the showrunner, would say, we didn't want to set up a false expectation that we were going into another campaign cycle on the show, so that we really wanted to establish she is truly a former president. She's dealing with all the anxiety, disrespect, headaches of entering private life after a career in the public sector as a senator, even before she was a vice president and president.
As writers, did you no longer want to write her in the White House? Did you want a new set of storylines for her?
I would say, you know, that Dave Mandel, the showrunner, pitched the idea of this season and last season when he took over the show from the creator, Armando Iannucci, 2 years ago. And he always had pitched... This totally comes from him, that she would lose at the election in a tie, as she did at the end of last season, and that she would be in private life the season we're showing now. And that was it. And of course, since he was new to the show, he had never worked on a lot of the previous stories, but he just saw that as a natural trajectory to do something different and to deal with this character of Selina Meyer and all her humanity or lack of humanity in different settings, so we're not, you know, doing the same thing over again, to be sure, but also exploring her as a character and taking her in new directions, even into a new city. She settles in New York.
So as an executive producer, did you immediately think that's a great idea? Or did you think like, wait, no, she has to be vice president or president. That's the premise of the whole series.
Thought it was fantastically creative. Indeed, it happened when Dave was still thinking of taking over the show, and he met with me and Julia Louis-Dreyfus for a drink in Los Angeles, and he pitched this entire thing. And I think both of us were kind of overjoyed at his creativity, and he really sort of saw around the corner of the show in perhaps a way that we, being so locked into what we've been doing for the four previous seasons, couldn't. So the freshness of us took, you know, we were taken with it immediately, and so was HBO when it was presented to them.
So that means that you've had to come up with storylines for an ex-president.
Yes.
Right now she's doing all the standard things. She's writing her memoir, though she has a pretty small advance that she's been given. She
yes.
wants a presidential library, although nobody seems to want to fund it.
Yes.
And she's trying to like burnish her legacy. Be that as it may.
Yes,
although
she likes to think of herself as being a half-termer like John Kennedy, she's not. She didn't last that long, and she inherited the presidency by default to begin with, and so she doesn't have much of a legacy to preserve or burnish, and yet she is dogged and incredibly narcissistic and trying to seize any bit of the limelight that she can.
So let's hear another clip, and this is a clip with Selina Meyer, the former president. After having gone to her predecessor's new presidential library, she really wants one too. So she's on a borrowed private plane with her current very small staff, Gary, played by Tony Hale, and Richard, played by Sam Richardson, and Andrew, her ex-husband, played by David Pasquese, and Selina's talking to them about wanting her own library.
I'm the only living president who doesn't have one. And you want to know why that is?
Because you served less than 1 year?
No, because nobody gives me any respect. I was a two-term senator. I was a congresswoman.
A mother?
No, I was the first woman vice president. And America cannot forget that.
Never forget. Oh, sorry, that's the Holocaust. Totally forgot.
I need a monument to Selina Meyer.
An institution.
Selina Meyer belongs in an institution.
It was a spa.
Let's do this. Oh, you know what? We're on an airplane. I know that.
What are you thinking about for location?
It's gonna be Yale. Yale has the prestige. Mm. And boys, is where I went to law school. So, I mean, Yale's just perfect.
Your outfits alone are gonna be a wing. Dresses, belts.
Now, look, I want you to start lining up architects. I want to talk to every Tom, Dick, and Geary out there.
Maybe a female candidate.
Well, we're not redoing a kitchen here, you know. And we need to tell them that the Kennedy Library is a reference point because, you know, he was also a part-termer.
Okay. <it's Julia
laughs> As I was saying, yeah.
So have you been watching carefully how Hillary is handling having lost her election and how President Obama is dealing with being out of office now that he's just begun to emerge again?
Yes, of course, part of it through the perspective of the show, which is, as I should add, perhaps gratuitously, it was written before we knew that Hillary Clinton was going to lose. And of course, well before we were watching her post-election blues and Obama's former presidential status. And watching them, you know, we see mirror images sometimes of what we did, you know, which is just amazing to us, the sort of Hillary in the woods. Selena's not quite in the woods, but she is sort of wandering around, not knowing what to do, how to assert herself, where to speak, what to say about anything, including to some extent the president who beat her, the female president who beat her. And Obama, of course, who's having what seems to be about as, at this early stage, as graceful and delightful an ex-presidency as you can have, and has gotten this huge advance for his book, as has the First Lady, is in contrast to, a quite stark contrast to Selena's sorry state.
So what did you think the outcome was going to be of the election while you were writing the current season of Veep?
I think everyone in the writer's room and on the show felt that, as the rest of the world did, that it would be Clinton. And it's not something we actively talked about because, as you know, We never reference contemporary politicians in the show. We've never mentioned Obama or Trump or Clinton. Selena isn't even identified by political party. So it's not directly relevant to what we're doing. But the first thing we felt was, as the 2016 election was really heating up last summer, that was just as our previous season, which had this outrageous election plot on Veep, was ending. And we thought, thank God it's already out there. People have already seen it and we hope laughed at it or with it without us having to compete with this raucous Clinton-Trump election, which then unfolded because we couldn't have competed with that. And then we thought after that, oh, how great that we have an ex-president next season and that'll be a change of pace. We thought it would be an interesting, assuming Hillary was going to be elected, we thought, oh, it'd be an interesting counterpoint to watch a woman who's not Hillary, Selena Meyer, lose the presidency, and what she was doing might be fascinating, or you know, some interesting bifurcated vision. And then, of course, that's not what happened. And now we're doubly glad, I guess, that we're not in the White House because we couldn't compete with this White House in terms of sheer farce.
You know, you mentioned that people aren't identified by party on Veep. And I'm wondering why that's true. I mean, certainly you wouldn't describe yourself as like an equal opportunity offender. I mean, you call it as you see it. You write political columns and you're very straightforward about who you think is doing a good job or a bad job. You call out parties for what they do. So like you have no personal interest in maintaining, you know, the facade of neutrality. You don't pretend to be neutral. So I can't speak for the other people in the Veep crew, but you know, why is it like we're not mentioning parties? And how do you feel about that?
I love it. It's one thing that originally drew me to Armando Iannucci was exactly a similar thing he did. He wrote and was Oscar nominated for a movie called In the Loop, and it was a movie about the run up to the Iraq War, set both in the State Department and in 10 Downing Street, a vicious satire, somewhat in the same vein as the Veep yet to be. And the word Iraq was never mentioned in that movie, nor were political parties of either country at play. And I felt what it allowed him to get at, and this was one of his central ideas in creating Veep, was a kind of algorithm of power and how it works, no matter who's in charge and how parties come and go and leaders come and go, there's still something sadly, tragically, comically, fatally the same. I grew up in Washington, and long before, obviously, I was a journalist or writing about politics. And I have to say, it really spoke to me in a way that no fictionalization of Washington ever has, because I saw that as a kid. I was my family wasn't in government, but I had a stepfather who was on the fringes of politics and lobbying and all of that. And you saw that one president would go out, one party would go out, one would come in, and it'd still be the same craven desire for power above all else among most participants. And and that, to me, is the biggest point of Veep.
You mentioned that your stepfather was on the fringes of lobbying. Exactly what fringe was he on?
He was a lawyer. What I've only really understood as an adult what he was really up to, but he was what you'd now call a K Street lawyer. And in fact, his office was on K Street, and he was his own little firm, and he represented airlines that in the days before Reagan deregulated airlines had to go through government agencies like the FAA and others, as I recall, to get routes. You had and he represented small international airlines that were always fighting the juggernauts of that time, Pan Am and TWA, if anyone remembers them. He was representing like Air India and Air France to try to get like the New York-London route for them. And so what did it mean? It meant ingratiating yourself with congressmen and senators, and even in his case, the Johnson White House. He knew Johnson a bit somehow from the late 1940s when they were both coming up in Washington. And he was a small player, but it really was like cajoling, I guess, quasi-bribery, all sorts of shenanigans that I innocently didn't fully understand, now completely understand. They were, and it's just everything I can't stand about Washington was happening right before me in a small scale.
So tell us what your job is as an executive producer of Veep.
I should say the title producer can mean many things on any given show, as well as from show to show. And also it's different between movies, theater, television. Everyone finds it confusing. My job has been a little bit of everything. It's been obviously very involved in scripts, being in the writer's room, particularly over the past couple of years when we started a writer's room under Armando. Scripts were sort of distributed more by email and largely in England. So it's there, you know, occasionally pitching stuff, but also hearing everything and in some ways functioning as a sounding board or an editor, part of the conversation. It's involved being involved in every, you know, big decision about casting, about promotion, about the credit sequence, about everything dealing with the network, and being in production and watching and help, you know, the best I can help manage a soundstage where, you know, there are 100 odd people at any given moment, and a lot of things are going on, and it's sort of Mickey and Judy putting on a show, and I'm a part of that.
Yeah, I'm wondering if your skills as a theater critic are helpful to you now, because when you want to criticize something and change it or improve it, you have the language skills, you have the vocabulary to really describe what you think the problem is, and that's a hard thing to put into words for a lot of people.
I think it's from. Absolutely, from my experience being a theater critic and learning how to articulate and, you know, diagnose problems with plays or figure out why things work in the theater. And I would argue, going back to my days as a teenage ticket taker, watching, you know, highly professional Broadway shows in the days when they tried out of town in cities like Washington, watching, standing in the back of the theater after taking tickets, watching night after night for free, which I could as an employee, really gifted people, you know, a Mike Nichols, a Jerome Robbins, a Neil Simon, whomever, come and constantly tinker with the plays that they were bringing to New York to get them right, was the best education I could have had as a critic well before I became a critic or even thought of being a critic. And all of that, I feel, has culminated for me in my work on Veep. And I'd also add one other aspect to it. Emotionally, I never really thought I wanted to be in the theater. I liked writing. I liked journalism. I liked writing about the theater. That's how I got into journalism. But it turns out I actually like being in the theater. And so it's kind of turned out to be a dream come true that I didn't know I had of working with a show, being with a show out of town in a sense, and being part of a company trying to make something that's funny and ideally and smart and that people, I hope, will like, and working with artists, you know, terrific actors and writers and other producers and directors. It's been a kind of an emotional high for 6 years now.
So between being a Broadway critic and writing your political columns, have you ever found it exhausting to have so many opinions?
Yes. Indeed, one of the reasons I gave up doing a op-ed column for The Times was, and it's also the reason 15 years earlier I decided to not be a drama critic anymore, is, yeah, I got sick of having to have opinions. And your opinions don't really change that much on the big issues. It's not like I'm suddenly going to be, you know, I don't know, go from being in favor of abortion rights to being against that. I mean, I guess I have some issues. Maybe I'm sure I have changed over time, including aesthetic issues involving the theater. But yeah, I think I like writing longer pieces that are, in terms of my journalistic work, that are not tied to having an up and down verdict about a particular politician issue or a play, you know, or a playwright.
Well, okay, so now people have opinions about your work. I mean, people have always had opinions about your work, but you're working on Veep. You're an executive producer, and Veep is getting reviewed, of course, in newspapers and magazines. What's it like for you as a former theater critic to read reviews of the TV show that you work on?
Well, obviously, the critics know nothing. you know, they have no idea of what's involved in putting on a show. what can I say? I'm not super sensitive about it, and we've been fortunate in that the reviews have generally been, you know, quite strong. Not all of them, and not all the time. It makes me reflect, actually, on my days of being a critic and realizing that there was
the harm that
I
you
thought,
did, the hurt that you caused,
the harm, the harm, the carnage that I called, caused. Yeah, no, maybe a little bit of that, but not. But you know, what really it makes me think of back on is to be quite critical of some of my criticism, not because of its impact or even that my opinions would really be any different, but that there's a lot I didn't know that I have learned. I mean, one of the things about working on this show has been, it's just an incredible, it's been an incredible learning experience for me, and about everything, including how actors work, you know, how script writers work. So, you know, things that I was very cocky about and thought I was certain about as a critic, I was wrong in some cases, but my taste wouldn't have changed. I don't think it's like now I would think that because of what I've learned, I think, you know, Cats is a great show suddenly. It's not like it's my opinion's changed, but my sense of my own knowledge has been humbled.
Frank Rich, it's been great to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And you sound so happy working on Veep. So I'm happy for you.
I actually am having the time of my life and have been it's crazy, since 2011. So
that's great. Frank Rich is a columnist for New York Magazine and an executive producer of the HBO series Veep. In a 2014 piece she wrote for The New Yorker, writer Dani Shapiro called herself a bit of an accidental memoirist. If that's so, it's been a lucky accident for her. Two of Shapiro's three memoirs, Slow Motion and Devotion, have been bestsellers. Her latest memoir is called Hourglass, and our book critic Maureen Carrigan says it's a winner.
Dani Shapiro's new memoir, Hourglass, opens on a scene from a marriage. On a winter's day, Shapiro looks out a window of her old house in Connecticut and spots her husband. Now pushing 60, he's standing in the driveway in his bathrobe, his pale legs stuffed into galoshes, aiming a rifle at the woodpecker who for months has been jackhammering holes into the side of their house. Shapiro's husband was once a foreign correspondent, accessorized with a gun and bulletproof vest when he ventured into war zones. But in that wintry moment of reckoning, he's more Elmer Fudd than Ernest Hemingway. You might imagine Shapiro witnessing that scene and joking, "It's come to this." But Shapiro isn't replaying that memory for laughs. As a writer, she's known more for ruthless self-interrogation and a tough, taking-it-on-the-chin tone. Her first and most celebrated memoir, Slow Motion, recounted how, as a young woman, Shapiro dropped out of college, became the mistress of a friend's stepfather, and grew estranged from her Orthodox Jewish parents until a devastating car accident transformed her into her mother's caretaker. Her other memoirs have explored the terror of coping with her then-infant son's life-threatening illness and her parents' deaths. But Hourglass is different. It's less an account of catastrophe than it is a clear-eyed inspection of the slow cracks certain to develop in a long marriage. Just as she watched that woodpecker ceaselessly rat-tat-tatting on the side of her house, Shapiro is attentive to the ways time steadily hammers away at the 18-year bond between her and her husband, exposing gaps as well as places where the framing seems strong. Shapiro's marriage to M as she calls her husband here, is her third and by far the longest. Jumping around in non-chronological, often disconnected, and almost always incisive short paragraphs, Shapiro dramatizes the dizzying ways a lifetime passes, loops around, speeds up, and sometimes seems to stand still. Shapiro describes the sensuousness of her courtship with M and their honeymoon in Paris, no less. She recalls the relief of ordinary parenthood after their son's medical emergency had passed, when, as Shapiro reflects, she and her husband were still young enough to believe that life holds only one close call per customer. In the present, that son is now about to go off to college, and Shapiro keeps shaking herself in dismay at the velocity of life. Quoting John Updike, Shapiro says, "For years, we had the persistent sensation in our life and art that we were just beginning." Shapiro is only 54, so although she may strike youngsters like, say, my undergrad students as old and crusty, her meditation on time and mortality seems somewhat premature. That's where M comes in. He's a bit older, and as Shapiro presents him, somewhat depressed. When she looks at M's face, Shapiro says she sometimes feels as though he has fled the premises. After years of reporting from war zones, M entered the film business. He writes screenplays that don't always get produced. As a consequence, the couple's income is unpredictable. In addition to its many other virtues, Hourglass underscores the tightrope tension of trying to support a middle-class lifestyle on writing. Shapiro admits she and M have first-world problems, but she's also ruthlessly clear about the trade-offs they unknowingly made in following their literary ambitions. She tells us they work 7 days a week and have no savings, no retirement plans, nothing to fall back on but each other. Ever since they first met, Shapiro says M has reassured her with the phrase, "I'll take care of it," whether the pesky it be a woodpecker or an electric bill. But of course, no one can always take care of it. That's the mundane, but nonetheless raw recognition at the core of Hourglass, that we're always bound to fall short on our promises to one another. Towards the close of this charged memoir, Shapiro describes an evening at home where she and M sit before the fire talking about writing, the vocation that binds them and also stirs up such anxieties in the marriage. Disappointments and fears, however, are set aside for another time. "Tonight," Shapiro says, "we will stay at the edge of the dark forest until together we are brave enough to go back inside." That's a beautiful line of poetry, and also not bad advice from Shapiro about how to pace oneself in a relationship that's hoping to go the distance.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Hourglass by Danny Shapiro. Our guest, Rick Ankiel, is a former major league ballplayer with an unusual story. He entered the big leagues in 1999 as an extraordinarily gifted pitcher, then one day, suddenly, mysteriously, lost that gift. He felt fine, but couldn't control his pitches, sending them over batters' heads or in the dirt nowhere close to the plate. He battled the problem for years, pitching in minor league parks where fans showed up in hard hats to mock him because his throws could go anywhere. Ankiel eventually left pitching and returned to the game as a power-hitting outfielder, a transition rare at the major league level. Ankiel writes about his struggle with the pitching demon and about his troubled childhood with an abusive father in a new memoir. He spoke to Fresh Air's Dave Davies about the book, The Phenomenon, Pressure, the Yips, and the Pitch That Changed My Life.
Well, Rick Ankiel, welcome to Fresh Air. The title of this book is The Phenomenon, which obviously has a double meaning. It's about a phenomenal athletic gift and also this mysterious phenomenon which threatens that gift. When you came up as a pitcher in the minor leagues in high school and then that first season as a rookie, how good were you?
Really good. You know, out of high school, I was the number one prospect in the country. And then, you know, again in the minor league, same thing. Number one pitcher in the country, number one prospect. You know, everything was going as good as it possibly could go.
I'm going to read a little piece. This is from Will Leach, the baseball writer. And you baseball players are sometimes a little modest, so I'm going to let Will Leach describe what you were like in your early years. He wrote, and I'm editing this a bit, but he writes, "Of all my years watching baseball, I never felt more acutely that some people were just touched, struck by Zeus's thunderbolt than when I first watched Rick Ankiel pitch. He just turned 20, but it was obvious there was no one like him. Broadcasters compared him to Steve Carlton, Randy Johnson, and Sandy Koufax. He made you feel you were watching history. It made you nervous to watch him, even back then, even before everything turned, because so much brilliance was packed into such a fragile shell. Ankiel vibrated with talent, and you worried he was a live wire with too much current flowing through it." I gather you didn't feel fragile back then.
No, I felt invincible. And you know, as a young man, and you know, realizing when you get put into the, you start judging yourself by the other people around you. And I remember going to a tournament in high school where it's the best talent in high school, and you start looking and saying, "Hey, I'm one of the best here." And then I played on the USA Junior team. And realizing that, you know, that I was better than some of the guys that were older than me that were going to be drafted that year, and I wasn't going to be drafted until the following year. So with all that happening, obviously you start dreaming, and my goal was, hey, I want to be one of the best pitchers that's ever lived, and I was heading in that direction. Everything that was happening around me, I felt like I was supposed to be there. I felt like I was supposed to be good. My fastball was hard, my curveball. You know, I felt like I could throw it past grown men, and there's nothing they could do about it.
Okay, so let's go back to that fateful moment. You'd had a great rookie year, and your team, the St. Louis Cardinals, is in the playoffs for the first time in a lot of years, right? And you're the starting pitcher for the first game. You're out there. You're in command. You get to the third inning. Your team has given you a lead. Then what happens?
You know, all I had to do was go out there and throw strikes, really, just keep my team in it. We scored all those runs off Greg Maddux, which never happens. You know, and all I got to do is go out there and pitch my game. I don't have to do anything special, just pitch a normal game, and we win, and here we go. We're 1-0 starting the playoffs. I threw a pitch that didn't quite sit right. I threw a fastball on the inner half, and when I threw to the inner half of the plate as a left-hander, it would cut a little bit in, and we had a catcher named Carlos Hernandez who came in to catch me, and he didn't quite know what the action on my pitches were. Mike Matheny, who was our normal catcher, had cut his hand with a hunting knife, so he was going to miss the entire rest of the season. And I threw that pitch, and something in the back of my mind, I just felt like, man, I just threw a pitch a wild pitch on national TV. And it really wasn't that bad of a pitch. I mean, if Mike was there, he would have caught it. Not saying that it would have been any different, but I brushed it off and kept going. And then, you know, all of a sudden, a few pitches later, I spiked a curveball. There were some pitches that the catcher couldn't even catch.
Over everybody's head, in other words.
Yeah. Correct. Yeah, past him, past the umpire. Just in the middle of nowhere, really. And you could tell, you know, if you go back and watch the video, you can just see the ball is really, it's just coming out of my hand funky and not correct. You know, I was so young, I didn't even understand what was happening. I remember saying to the media after the game, "Oh, it's a mechanical flaw. This will never happen again." And even in between that start, and then I started another game, game two in the second series of the playoffs, my bullpen session in between those games was lights out. I had pinpoint control. I felt like, all right, I got this licked. I'm over it. Or whatever it was, it's gone. Then during the second game, same thing. It just started happening again. I started launching balls. You know, and now I have this feeling something's not right, and I'm not understanding what's not right. I tried to remember all my mechanical keys as far as, like, keep your weight back, lead with your shoulder. Every pitcher has them, and every hitter has them too. If you get out of whack, you have something that gets you back to normal. And nothing was working, and I couldn't figure it out. And then, you know, going into the off season, you know, I felt like, all right, maybe this will be good. I'll get away from the game, and then when I come back next year, it'll be, you know, I'll be fine. But what happened was when I came back the next year, it was in me deeper and darker than it was before.
When this would come, and this is something that, as we'll hear, you experienced a lot of times over the next few years, as best you can describe, What did it feel like on the mound when this happened?
Fast forwarding into 2001, now it became just anxiety ridden. I mean, it consumes you. You can't get away from it. You know, I'm driving down the street and I see some kids playing catch, and you know, I'll stop and watch them and think, man, it looks easy for them. Why can't I do that? Or I'm watching how they throw it. And I, you know, I had to change my entire routine because I used to go home and watch baseball every night. I loved the game. I wanted to watch other guys and see how they perform and see what they do. Now I'm watching them and thinking, man, I'll try to throw like he does. I had this cinder block wall behind my house, and I would, you know, I'd go back there and throw 100 pitches after I'd turn on the game, and now all of a sudden you can't stop thinking about it. And I'd go back there and throw pitch after pitch after pitch, trying to figure it out, hoping the next day that I show up to the field, I'm going to be me again.
Did you give this thing a name?
I left it as the yips. I mean, it has so many names. That's the thing. Scientifically, it doesn't even have a name. Some people call it the yips, the monster, whiskey fingers. It has multiple names.
Yeah, it's funny because the yips I always think associate with a golfer who has a putt mm-hmm. and gets nervous. So it's some psychological thing that just happens, right?
Right, and it's a psychological that does cause a mechanical breakdown, but it does start in the mind. And you know, I'm sure at first, you know, I was in denial, and I just thought, hey, I can beat this with mechanics because I know what I want to do. I know what my mechanics look like, what they feel like, what I'm supposed to do. And that's the crazy part about it. You're standing out there on the mound. You know exactly what you want to do and how you want to do it, and your body and brain will not let you do it.
This happened to you in a playoff game, and it wasn't some obscure last place team. I mean, everybody in the country saw this thing, which didn't help you. And then you go into the offseason. Now, it was clear this was a psychological thing. And when people try to look at what's going on in their heads, they often go back to their childhood. You were not blessed with the easiest of childhoods. Tell us about your father.
Yeah, you know, my father was an alcoholic and drug abuser, convict. You know, been arrested more than a dozen times. You know, the thing about it was he could be a good guy when he was sober, but he would disappear for a few days, and when he came home, it was always in this drunken, violent rage. You know, he would abuse my mother, and you know, me and my brother would wake up in the middle of the night and just hear my mom screaming for help. And you know, it's tough. I mean, I remember having to drive him home from the bars when I was 12 years old, or me and my mom would go find him, and then we're following him in the car, and he's weaving in and out of traffic, and you're wondering if he's going to run headfirst into a tree or a car and kill himself and somebody else. You know, and it's just a tough way to grow up.
Sure, and it must be so tough when your mom's going through that and you're a little kid. I mean, what can you do about it?
You're exactly right, and you know, for a long time I carried a lot of guilt because I wish, you know, when I heard her screaming, you know, as a young 8-year-old and, you know, all those young ages, you know, I wish I would have went out there with a bat and hit him over the head and been done with it. But, you know, I was young and I was scared, and you know, I never did. And we'd wake up in the morning and nobody would talk about it, and they would act like everything was fine. And, you know, I really feel bad for my mom. She had a tough life, and I wish it could have been better for her. And you know, but I am thankful now. She lives down where I live in Jupiter, and you know, she gets a chance to help me raise my kids, and we get a chance to have a do-over on our lives.
Did your dad abuse you and your brother too?
No. I mean, verbally, yes. Physically, I mean, we were spanked, but usually, you know, for getting in trouble. But, you know, when he came home in those drunken rages, we knew to stay out of the way, that's for sure.
You know, we'll talk more about how you tried to cope with this thing that was making it impossible for you to pitch. But do you think that you were suffering from post-traumatic stress? I mean, this is not easy stuff for a kid.
No. I'm sure I had some post-traumatic stress, as you can say in there. But then for me, how do you explain all the good pitching in between that? I mean, right. This happened when I was 13 and the yips started when I was 21. And okay, so if we say that, well, then what happened with everything in between that? And why was I so good for so long and able to push so many things away? And just, you know, baseball is my safe place, and really baseball is what saved me. It got me away from all that stuff and out of that house and was my savior.
So you got better and better, performed well in high school, and eventually were drafted by the St. Louis Cardinals and got a $2.5 million signing bonus. That's a sign of the more modern baseball times. And it struck me that what an amazing reversal this must have been. For all those years, you were powerless in relation to your dad. Now you had more money than he'd ever seen. Did that change the dynamics between you?
Yeah, you know, one thing, too, is that you know, he had all these stories he would always say of how good he was and, you know, how he was the best and all these things. And in reality, I became better than his stories, his made-up stories, because he wasn't that player that he says he was. But, yeah, it definitely changed the dynamic, and it gave me power back to where, like, you know, I don't need to listen to you, and I'm not under your control. And for me, it was all my dreams coming true. I mean, since I was a young boy, all I wanted to do was be a big leaguer, and everything was happening as it should, and I was on the path to becoming what I wanted to become.
Did your dad have an expectation that you were going to take care of him financially?
Yeah, he had an expectation that the entire signing bonus was his. You know, even before I signed, when the talks of how much money I might actually sign for started, you know, he was talking about buying this $1 million condo in the next town over and renovating it and everything else. And if not that, then how about the $500,000 house on the water, you know, for the family, because now all of a sudden we're such this close family. You know, so yeah, I think he thought the whole bonus was his, not just some of it.
So getting back to the story of what happened here, it was in the playoffs of your rookie year that this bizarre thing happened where you were suddenly throwing wild pitches, hitting batters, throwing it back to the screen. And you had an off season, 5 months to try and figure this thing out. And you were determined to do that, to recapture your control. You come back to training camp with the St. Louis Cardinals, and you had kind of a rough spring training, but you got on the team as a starter, and you had to go out there and pitch, knowing that this was still kind of in your head. How did you cope?
You know, I was drinking more than I wanted to. The biggest thing I always talk about is that it consumes you, and you can't get away from it. It's virtually impossible to stop thinking about it. You know, as you mentioned, it's your livelihood. It's everything I've ever worked for, and it's being taken away from me. So going into that game in 2001, I'm just going to start against Randy Johnson in Arizona. I'm on the way to the ballpark that day. I'm as nervous as you could possibly be. I know it's not going to go well. I mean, I know I have no chance. It's like everything was building up to this moment, and, you know, your nervous system and everything that comes with that, all the emotions. You know, and a couple weeks before that, somebody had said, hey, maybe you should just try a pitch and buzz. You know, maybe it'll take the edge off. I blew it off. I didn't really, you know, give it much thought. Ah, yeah, haha, that might work. And then I'm sitting there before the game, and Daryl Kyle, who was my mentor, I went to him privately and said, hey, can you go get me a bottle of vodka and pour it in a water bottle? And he's like, I understand. You got to do what you got to do. And I drank before the game, and, I'm warming up, and all of a sudden the ball's coming out of my hand free again. And, you know, it worked. I ended up beating Randy Johnson, and I remember sitting in the dugout during the third inning or so, and I could feel the anxiety trying to overcome the alcohol, and I just had to sit there and keep drinking. But it did work that first game, and because it worked, I tried it the second game. You know, after my first game, I told Harvey Dorfman, hey, you know, I had to drink before the game, and you know, but it worked. And he's like, hey, listen, I understand. I know you had to do what you got to do, but listen, it's not real. And you're going to need to face the music. And that second game, I tried it again. And, you know, sure enough, the feeling, the anxiety just overcame the alcohol. And, you know, the game just didn't go well. I was throwing balls again. And I realized, all right, this isn't the answer. And I just had to face the music.
You had a few more starts, and you know, things were going badly, 12 walks in 11 innings. So they sent you down to the minor leagues to get away from the pressure to work on it. Did that help?
Not at first, it didn't. No, I went to AAA, and it just seemed like it kept getting darker and worse. And then I went all the way down to rookie league. And, you know, finally in rookie league, it seemed like, you know, there's not very many people in the stands. There wasn't, you know, TV cameras weren't there hounding me at all times. I did start to pitch really good in 2001. I was actually the pitcher of the year down there in rookie ball, and as I should have been, it being that I had already been in the big leagues and whatnot.
So you spent a lot of years trying to get back that groove that you had when you first came up, and there were elbow problems. You had surgery and recovery, and eventually got back to the point where you went and you pitched respectably in the Cardinals bullpen for a while, but yep. Came a point where you decided it was time to retire. Why?
You know, when I came back and pitched respectively and successfully in that 04 season back out of the bullpen, what it took for me to do that with all-day mental training from the time I woke up to the time I went to bed, I mean, it was whether I was counting backwards from 100 or I had all these little techniques that I would do, I really became a shell of a person of who I was You know, normally I like to joke around, have fun with the guys, pull pranks, you know, just be in the mix of things. And I couldn't do that. And, you know, I just felt like it was becoming unhealthy. And I didn't think it was a life that I wanted to live. And I understood that, you know what, pitching just isn't for me anymore.
So you walked in, you told Tony La Russa, the manager, he said, take a day to think about it. He said, don't need a day.
I don't need a day. And I go home that day. I mean, I'm not home an hour. My agent, Scott Boras, calls and says, hey, are you ready to go play? And I'm thinking, is nobody hearing me? I just told you I retired from baseball. I'm done. I'm not a pitcher anymore. And he's like, no, not a pitcher. Are you ready to go be an outfielder? I'm like, what are you talking about? And he's like, seriously, do you want to be an outfielder? And I'm like, you know what? You got to give me some time to think about this. I just stopped pitching an hour ago. So I hang up the phone. For 4 or 5 hours, I'm laying there on the couch. I'm trying to understand and feel what this would be like. And then I get to the point where I visualize myself hitting a home run in the big leagues after coming back as a position player. And once I did that, I picked up the phone. I called him and I said, yeah, I'm 100% in. He's like, let me call the Cardinals and ask.
Yeah, now this is a remarkable thing. I mean, it just does not happen much at the major league level that somebody goes from a pitcher to a position player or vice versa. The Cardinals were game for it.
They were. Walt called me back and said, hey, Hank, you know, we're in.
So you played several years, ended up playing with several teams, retired in 2013, this time for good. You're now married. You have two sons. What are you doing today?
I'm a sports analyst for Fox Midwest. I have a 4-year-old and I have a 6-year-old, which take up most of my time. I'd love to get more time as a broadcaster and fill more time with Fox. So we'll see where that goes. And like I said, with my kids, that's what keeps me busy now.
Well, Rick Ankiel, we wish you the best. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
Rick Ankiel spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies, who is also WHYY's senior reporter. Ankiel's new memoir is called The Phenomenon. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Heidi Simon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Teresa Madden, Mooj Zaidi, and Thea Chaloner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. I'm Terry Gross.